You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, everybody. It is the 3CR Gardening Show time. It is great to be here with everyone again. My name's Stephen Wells, and I'm back in the host chair. They've let me back in, which is great. And I still have my learner's plate on, so bear with me if anything does change, because it's been a great morning so far of learning, which is wonderful. But I'm joined today by a wonderful panel of experienced and knowledgeable, wonderful horticultural folks. So in the studio we have Greg Balderston from Forest Glade Gardens.
Morning.
Good morning. We have Jeremy Francis from Cloud Hill Gardens and Nursery. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we have Richard Barley from a wonderful horticulturalist who many of you will know, previously the executive director of the RBG in Kew, back in here in Australia now for the last year.
Morning.
Wonderful to see you. Thank you. Surprise, see. And for those of you who have been listening along previously or watching our socials, you may have thought that Chloe would be on as well, but she is here in the studios just to help and guide me as we go along. So wonderful to see you all. I did actually kind of wonder about whether this unofficial theme might be that we've, from the mountaintops to the valleys in between, because we've got Greg and now Richard from up Mount Bassett away direction, and you, Jeremy, from the Dandenongs. So we've got two mountaintops, and it was going to be me and Chloe from the valley in between in Melbourne. but it's wonderful to see you all, and look forward to a great show. We've got some fantastic time to chat and enjoy hearing all about what's been happening in your worlds. Greg, how have you been?
Yeah, good. It's we drove down a bit of rain this morning, so that's it's always good to see that. It's been a weird season. It's like we had a whole lot of the seasons in the last month or so, where it sort of went back from summer to autumn, then back to summer, then spring, then summer again, and yes. Now we're finally back into autumn.
It's kind of like it's teasing us, but sort of going, regressing more than what it normally does.
Yeah, it's a very strange weather to see, you know, grass go spring. There's a farm I work on, and the cows are loving it because the grass just went spring green again.
Yes, yes.
The autumn colour at Forest Glade stopped halfway through too, so that we had an early flush of autumn.
Right.
When the autumn season's supposed to happen.
Yes.
And then there's still like Japanese maples and other trees up there that are bright green, look like they're in the middle of the season. They haven't started colouring at all. So
you haven't had those cold morning snaps?
No, I think we've only had two nights under, say, 4 degrees or something like that. We had a mild frost one night about 4 weeks ago, and that's about it. Everything else is sort of quite warm and, yeah, very strange weather.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Jeremy, has that been the case up in your neck of the woods?
I feel like the weather is a constant topic nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm interested about the autumn, the weather, that little
the first half of autumn was pretty boring. Our big maples barely produced any colour at all. In fact, they dropped half their leaves without
had
enough of the season, and
yep,
down they came. A little tiny bit of colour in the second half, but the colour right now is pretty good. Encheanthus and quite a few different things. The plant I had to check on just a few minutes ago, Neo Shirakia.
Yes.
Japonica. Yeah, in WA, people, virtually the only tree that will colour up is the Chinese tallow tree, which Sapium sabifrum in the old days.
Yep.
I always knew that there was a Japanese relative, and as Yamina was closing a few years ago, I was chatting to Don Teese and saying, "God, you know, I've always been trying to track down this Japanese cousin of the Chinese tallow tree," and he said, "We got half a dozen over there."
Great.
Of course.
Of course he did.
So planted one of those. So that was, 8 years ago?
Yep.
And it's looking, it has been absolutely magnificent. Virtually the best autumn colouring plant I've ever seen. Just turning bright red and running through its gold in the centre of the shrub.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Yes.
Was it only one that you planted, or do you now...
Only one, yes.
Are you now thinking you've got a couple of extras?
Well, that's right. I need another half a dozen, yeah. This, anyway, the main thing is the autumn colour is the second half of the season is going to be good.
Great.
Yeah, starting from this weekend.
Yep, yep. And what about you, Richard? What's been happening around your neck of the woods?
Well, so we're in Woodend, and clearly it's been a bit colder in Woodend than it has up on the mount. It's not surprising the cold air sort of drains downhill at night. And we had at least one reasonable frost and quite a few clear and coldish nights. So actually the autumn colours have been spectacular around, you know, off the mount, as it were, on the lower bits in the valleys. Some bits just coming to the end, but others holding on really nicely. So spectacular still, and the beautiful clear days have been wonderful. Of course, that's not today because it's pouring with rain, which again is also good. We need that as well.
Yes, I was chatting with someone the other day. I was in the optimistic mode. They saw me at work in the morning, and I was in shorts, and they're like, "Aren't you cold?" I'm like, "It's foggy," and what happens after the fog? It clears to be a beautiful blue sky, wonderful day, and that's when I'll be going, "Isn't it great that I'm in my shorts?" So it's wonderful to watch the changing weather at the moment.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. And we seem to be getting a lot of that moisture coming down across from the northwest at the moment, don't we? Sort of
we do,
north
yes.
to south. So that's
which is an odd weather pattern too for us here.
Yeah.
Generally, we don't, you know, it's southwesterlies and westerlies, not northwesterlies and northeasterlies at this time of year. Yeah.
It's the bigger rains usually that come out of the north.
Yeah.
It's one of those really odd things, isn't it? The Nullarbor is becoming a lot wetter. Sadly, the southwest of WA is becoming a lot drier. And, whether the rain gets through to Victoria or not, it depends on the... sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
Yes.
So do you think if trees start growing on the Nullarbor, they'll have to change its name? Is that on the agenda?
It's really depressing what's going on at the moment, that's for sure. I've got a nephew who works in climate change with the United Nations, so we sort of chat about this every Christmas. And, we were both saying a few months ago that, you know, we thought this would take 100 years, and the problem would be that the climate change would sneak up and there'd be a lot of having to convince people that it was happening. But, it's just happening at such an incredible rate that, surely it doesn't take much convincing of people.
It still seems
maybe
to
it
be
still
though,
does.
Yeah. Yeah, still might take it.
But you only have to look at what's going on with the rainfall in the dry areas of Western Australia, and suddenly it's getting rather wet.
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
So yeah, it's fascinating to watch. I grew up in Adelaide, and having moved over to Melbourne many years ago, we'd always normally go, "Oh, look at what the weather is in Adelaide the day before, and that's then what we're going to get here in Melbourne." Used to be more consistently with that, but now I've got relatives that are still there, and they're talking about the rain one day, and we're like, "Oh, it hasn't come to us."
Let's face it, that's what the Bureau of Meteorology has done for decades, is just look at what Adelaide has, and then they say,
"That'll be what Melbourne will get."
And then they take the day off. I'm just kidding.
But it's true. It was a bit like that in WA. So I was farming. We were farming north of Perth on the Darling Escarpment, so we, a fairly high spot, well, relatively speaking, everything faced west, and we could see the weather coming across the Indian Ocean from about 2 days away.
Right.
Back in the days when there were only 24-hour forecasts, and we would have a look and figure it out, and then we'd look at the forecast and think, oh, I think ours might be more accurate, and half the time it was.
Yeah. I guess that's the interesting thing when, you know, being this side of the continent, you're always thinking, you're looking at what the previous states have got, but WA,
no,
it's just ocean.
Back in the 60s, 70s, there was hardly any information coming in from the Indian Ocean. So the forecasts were pretty rough and ready.
Yeah. I mean, they are pretty good now, to be honest.
Very true. Things have changed, it. Yes. Yeah. Satellites and all that stuff, they do some good.
Yes. Greg, I'm interested to know, with the changing seasons for you, you're well and truly into the fungi. This is the season that it's starting, you know, things start to change with that.
Mm-hmm.
Are you noticing a lot of that in gardens?
It's, again, with the season this year, that we had some quite wet weather, like late summer going into early autumn, and there's a flush of fungi back then.
Yeah.
And then it dried out for 4 weeks and had nothing. And just, when did I go out? It was a couple of nights ago. I think it was last Tuesday night. I was went for a walk up one of the valleys on the mount in the dark at night time.
Yes.
And it was a perfect night. It was about 2 days after it had rained, 3 days after it had rained, perfectly still and clear.
Yes.
Animals everywhere, including one I couldn't recognise, which was a bit eerie.
What do you mean by that?
Okay. It was up in the trees and it sounded like a primate. I'm guessing it was either an owl making a weird noise or one of the possums up there but it wasn't a sound that I'm used to. It was like a howler monkey up in the
trees. Macedon ape.
It was very strange. But
no black pumas.
The mushrooms are well and truly
not
that.
The yowie.
Well, it could be, yeah. There's people that say they're around most parts. So I think Victoria is pretty low on the sightings for yowies and things. So the mushrooms are definitely, with the last sort of wet, and now it is getting a bit colder, the soil temperature's down. So you've got all the wood rotting species which just pop up when it's wet.
Yes.
And all the mycorrhizal species which have been really confused because they were starting to pop up things in late summer because of the moisture, and then it dried out again, and so they were sort of a bit confused. But a good example is the coral fungi. I haven't seen in the forest up there much at all for the last couple of years.
Right.
And when I went for a walk the other night, I spotted three or four species. And as I say, I haven't seen them for a couple of years. So
that's interesting.
It's a nice little... I actually took some photos the other night to put on iNaturalist. So it was, and there's a couple of species in there I hadn't seen for a couple of years. So that was nice, yeah.
Are they likely to be, is that a seasonal, are they usually present every year or do they have a lull?
There's so many different species. You've got to be in the right place at the right time for these things. So the real common ones you see everywhere all the time, as long as it's wet and cool. Then there's others, you know, there's mushrooms I've seen once and I might not ever see again.
Right.
A coral fungi I found a few years ago, a little purple one. I think it's had a name change recently, so I won't try and pretend that I know what the new name is or... even if I can remember the old name, but it was one of the purple coral fungies. I've been out looking for that several times and I've only seen it once in 10 years.
Very elusive.
Yeah, so, and there's plenty of stuff like that. There's plenty of things I've seen and thought, next time I see one of those, I'll take a photo of it and you never see it again.
Gosh, that's a great example of being in the moment.
Yeah. I think that's why I like you get in a flow state. You're out in the forest. It's dark.
Yep.
All you can see is what's in your headlamp, the light of the headlamp.
Gosh.
And everything just fades away and you just go through the bush, me and the dog.
Yep.
And you're listening to animals and
odd sounds.
Yeah, looking for the mushrooms and, again, things like mycorrhizal species, you know that you've seen that one growing underneath that eucalypt. So every year you can go back around the same time, usually, and if you're going to see it, you'll see it. Or there's a good chance you'll see it. So there's a bit of that. And, yeah.
It's, I imagine you've got a either a literal map or a very good mental map of where you've seen.
Yeah, very good mental map. Yep. And being knowing a little bit of the botany up there really helps too. Well, there was one night I was lost in the Bringo Valley, which is one of the bigger areas up there. And there's the creek system splits into quite a few little tributaries as you get near the top.
Yep.
And so I've crossed a creek thinking I'm in one part of the forest and I was in a completely different part of the forest. And the only reason I figured it out was because I'm walking up what I thought was back to my car and I'm going, there shouldn't be bracken ferns growing on this side where I'm walking up. And I realised I was actually walking eastward instead of westward.
Right.
Just because that the brackens will, the bracken fern will only grow on the west-facing slopes of those valleys up near the top.
Yes.
So, yeah, did a U-turn and went down the valley, across the creek and up the other side and found my way back to the car, yeah.
Very astute, yes. And because that's very true. And you notice on the Dandenongs too, there is distinct vegetation changes on different sides of the...
Yeah, those habitats and ecosystem change.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about Macedon, I think, is because it's such a little island of what it is, there's so many different micro-habitats. Like you can do a 15-kilometre walk and go through so many different types of habitat from, you know, the northern slopes of Mount Macedon to the southern valleys. You can go from, you know, a eucalyptus regnans forest and acacia dilbata, alpine ash, and then into mesmates and viminalis on the north side and, you know, dry sclerophyll sort of stuff. And it just completely changes from alpine to dry to rainforest, essentially, within a couple of kilometres. Yeah.
Yep. Quite amazing when you actually look past what the general public may do as a green... I just see it as a green forest, as opposed to all that incredible detail within such a short area.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing. It's a
very interesting spot, I think. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Jeremy, what's happening in your neck of the woods? Are you out... fungi spotting as well, or are you immersed in
interesting, just listening to Greg. I actually had Don Teese visiting yesterday.
Yes.
And he mentioned that amelaria had done a little bit of damage to one or two of the trees in his garden. And we got into a conversation about amelaria, and we were sort of comparing notes. There's a theory, and I'd be interested to see to hear what Greg thinks, that amelaria is a problem with monocultures, that the funguses, you need a greater diversity of funguses, the healthier the ecosystem is, and amelaria is a problem of a disturbed ecosystem, and then it suddenly it takes over and starts killing everything. So, number one, is this correct? Number two, how do we encourage diversity of funguses, I guess?
Well, there's the honey fungus or the amelaria. There's an introduced species or two, and there's one or two native species. I think there's two native species. So out in the forest, you only see them in already sick trees generally. So if you see amelaria infected in a tree, it's usually had some storm damage or... you know, it's at the end of a drought or halfway through a drought or something like that. So the trees are usually under stress before they get infected. And as you say, if you've got a monoculture, that can make it a lot worse because these... I think one of the oldest known living organisms on Earth is an amelaria.
That's what I understand.
Yeah, it's
taken
eating
over a whole mountainside.
Well, it's eating. Apparently, it's been chasing an aspen around a mountainside for about 250,000 years.
Right.
So this amelaria is eating this aspen crop because you know it grows like couch grass. It just suckers everywhere. And they've just been chasing each other around the forest for 250,000 years.
Wow!
And it's the same organism.
It's the same organism. So at Forest Glade, we've got a problem with amelaria in the Japanese maples, because it's not a monoculture, but we've got a close to a monoculture at Forest Glade because Cyril, the owner, who was responsible for planting it all, had an obsession with rhododendrons and Japanese maples. So we've got all these seed-grown Japanese maples and, you know, tens of thousands of rhododendrons all jammed into this, you know, 15 acres or whatever. And there's an armal area that's probably takes up about a fifth of the whole property. And I'm fairly certain it's the same organism. And it will go from the top gate of the property right down to the house, which is in the centre of the property. And every few years, a tree starts looking a bit off. You know, there's trees that we've lost and cut out and removed. There's armillaria mushrooms sprouting up from old tree stumps. And there's not a lot you can do about it, except for keeping your plants healthy and trying to, you know, create diversity in what's there and getting rid of those monocultures. But once it's in the tree, once it's in the ground, there's not a lot you can do about it because the only treatment would be a fungicide, which is going to kill all the good stuff, which is the diversity. Yeah. Well, you're not after the plant diversity, you're after the fungal diversity.
Well, that's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
So travelling around England a couple of years ago, the first place we got to was Great Dixter, and chatting with Fergus Garrett about the biodiversity audit that it's been running there over the last few years. And that's one of the rules, no fungicides, no pesticides, no fungicides, weedicides, tricky as well.
Yep.
But fungicides in particular, they're completely indiscriminate.
And it can do far more damage than what you know, the armillaria might kill a tree once every 20 years. And if you take all the fungus out, you're going to have pretty much the first thing that'll come back is probably the armillaria because you're not going to kill it by putting fungicides on the soil because it's inside the trees.
Yeah.
So the only way to get rid of it is to remove all the infected tree matter, which is mostly the roots, you want to remove.
Soil profile.
Yep. Yeah. So you're not going to get rid of it. And they have rhizomorphs. They just travel through the soil and it's like melted black plastic travelling through the soil. And they're a really amazing organism. But
I did hear from a gardener doing maintenance work in one of the suburbs, and I'm not too sure where in Melbourne this was, that he was asked to work in the garden, which was absolutely infested with armillaria, and also half a dozen surrounding gardens. There's the one organism had taken over a whole section of street and had done a huge amount of damage.
Mm.
Very nasty.
It is, because then it becomes a very localised management process of making sure you're not going to spread continue that spread.
And like we say, the best way to do it is through diversity.
Yep.
And trying to keep things as healthy as possible. And I would also say not to dig underneath trees that are either infected or at risk of being infected. So every time you nick a stump or a root or put a scar on that tree, it's a potential infection point for the armillaria.
It's a wound.
So don't stress the tree. Yeah,
diversity is the rule there. And that was the thing about Great Dixter. We were there at the end of June a couple of years back, and then we went back 5 weeks later, the planting, world championship planting. we're visiting Sissinghurst at the same time and spent some time with Troy Smith. It's interesting that Troy and Fergus Garrett compare notes two or three times a week. So these ideas are spreading everywhere.
Yep.
So it's really, really quite inspirational, actually. Wesley a few days later, and the same thing applies.
Very good.
As one would expect, I suppose, with the Royal Horticultural Society.
Yes, all interconnected.
Yeah.
Well, you're
In terms of Cloud Hill, well, we're just thankful we're getting some autumn colour, and no particular projects on at the moment. It's just steady as she goes, and then just seeing how the season is going to treat us, really.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
No, we start again in the spring.
Yes. Very well. You're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. My name is Stephen Wells, and in the studio we have Greg Balderston, we have Jeremy Francis, and Richard Barley. We encourage you to join us, all you wonderful listeners. We have a great panel here of wonderful and experienced people. So if you've got questions, we would love to hear from you. If you've got something you'd want to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can call in on 9419 0155 or text on 0488 809 855. Just being mindful that if you do text, don't attach photos. We can't see the photos on our system. But if you do have a question for us and you want to send in some photos, please also email us during the week. Our email is 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. And obviously for those of you who may be sleeping in and you catch up with us on the podcast, hello and welcome, and we look forward to hearing from you in due course as well. Now, Richard, wonderful to have you in here.
Thank you.
Good to see you, a bit of a surprise visit. And we embrace that and go with the flow.
We're going with the flow, exactly.
But I'm very interested to know, because next week we have a Botanic Gardens theme, and there's a very good reason for that. So I'd love to hear what you've been up to and what's happening in the coming week, because you, Botanic Gardens are your thing. You've come back from being the executive director at the RBG in Kew in the UK. It's been a year now. We're in May. Yeah. So it's been, has it gone quick?
Since we've been back, it probably has gone quickly. We've spent, most of the time sort of wrestling our house and garden back into livability, I suppose, after we had 12 years of tenants in the house.
And, wow.
And tenants are fine, but they don't tend to...
They don't garden like you might garden.
That's a good way of putting it. And so there was a lot to repair and a lot of blackberries to remove. There still are a lot of blackberries to remove. The rabbits are slightly less rampant than they were.
Yes.
But there's a lot to be done. So anyway, it's been a busy year. I've sort of enjoyed sort of getting back into the circles of Botanic Gardens people back here in Victoria and Australia, and I'm now director of BGANZ, which is Botanic Gardens Australia New Zealand, which is the sort of peak overarching body that exists for the purposes of coordinating and promoting and assisting botanic gardens across Australia and New Zealand. And in fact, we are here at the start of Botanic Gardens Week, so it's very timely that I'm in here this morning rather than next week when it would be all done and dusted. So Botanic Gardens Week runs from the 18th to the 24th of May. And the theme of it is about the benefits to people's health from being in gardens. So it's the sort of tagline is where your health grows. And there's a series of activities for people to undertake in different gardens. There are different challenges to sort of register for online and undertake. And, you know, there are talks, there are webinars, there's all manner of things happening from the length and breadth of the country. And I think, you know, we are so fortunate here to have such a richness of botanic gardens. And in Victoria especially, because, you know, by 1870, we had 21 botanic gardens. And
wow.
No other state or area at the time as they were had more than one.
Yep.
So from, you know, from the mid-19th century, we as a state embarked on this very, very unusual path of having botanic gardens all over the place, a lot of it driven by people like Baron von Mueller, who wanted to see which plants from other parts of the world would grow well here, which had economic benefit and things like that. But also, yep. I think, because the people in the developing towns, particularly if there was any wealth there from gold or wool or what have you, I think they saw having a botanic garden as a symbol of civilization, and yes. It's never more so. So we have these wonderful gardens. We have a lot of new botanic gardens also.
How many would we have? Do we have a definitive number? I don't know, because some, as you were saying before, so a lot of them are volunteer-supported and run.
Yeah. There's somewhere between 35 and 40 in the state.
Great.
And some are quite recently developed, which is great. It's good that people are still recognising the value of having botanic gardens, putting in the time, the work, and finding the resources and finances and doing that, rather than just thinking, well, aren't we lucky we've got all these old bits and pieces and we don't need to do anything current. So So, and the newer gardens often have a stronger sort of environmental focus. They might be conserving habitats or, you know, local floras or what have you. So it's a really, really great network across this state, but also across the whole country and New Zealand as well.
Yep.
So Botanic Gardens Week, get out there, get into your local botanic garden, just enjoy being there. And as I said, if you look up on the BGANZ, BGANZ website, you'll see there are a range of activities to undertake that don't take much time, but just things like noticing particular colours or listening for particular things or some gentle exercise or just mindful sorts of things. Yeah. So
excellent.
It's all good. Yeah.
Very good. I know with the – it's great. I've been watching Cranbourne, so that's celebrating its 20 years this year. And I remember when it first was established and having the thought that it's great, it's pretty special, having seen predominantly the Melbourne – Botanic Garden site and established mature trees, been in place for many years, to see Cranbourne as at a young stage and then be part of watching it evolve to become mature trees, to become a changing landscape, is pretty special.
It's a very interesting story, the whole Cranbourne story, because actually it was the 1940s when they started looking for a second site. The Maud Gibson Trust, which is a benevolent trust associated with the Botanic Gardens, they were looking for a site that because it was recognised that in the Melbourne Gardens you couldn't grow a good selection of the sort of drier, sort of sandy soil native plants, and they felt that was something they should do. So it actually took until the mid-1960s to find the Cranbourne location, which at the time was a Commonwealth Army Reserve.
Yes.
And then I think it was Henry Bolte managed to negotiate that away from the Commonwealth for a small fee, and then again it took until the 1980s to get the some of the site open.
Yep.
And then the concept of the Australian Garden developed mostly through the 90s. So it's time, I guess it shows you that it sometimes these things don't happen overnight. They happen because of, you know, people have a vision and they are persistent and determined to do it and deliver it. And that is the Australian Garden as it is now. And also, I mean, Cranbourne has the beautiful bushland. You know, the walks through the woodlands and the swamps and things there are just spectacular. You'll be saying hello to a few tiger snakes now and then, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's all right. That's part of the ecology of the environment.
Yeah.
We've got someone who's popped in a text message saying, how are the Gisborne Botanic Gardens looking?
Gisborne, so that's one down on the creek in Gisborne, and it has a focus on New Zealand flora. I walked through it a few weeks ago. It was looking okay. It's probably one of those sort of slow burners that I'm sure there are people. I actually don't know that whether the Shire of Macedon Ranges is putting a lot of resources into it, but it seems to be developing. There's some new areas of planting and things like that. Yep. And of course, just up the road is Kyneton, which is an historic botanic garden, and that seems to have a new sort of burst of energy as well. In fact, it's probably looking better now than it has certainly as long as I've known it, and that's largely due to volunteer input and the Shire sort of recognising the value of what they have. Malmesbury, just the next stop up the road, has the Arbutus collection. Then you have Castlemaine, and you know, you can sort of see that. Particularly
up those, line up.
Yeah, so, yeah, right Bendigo. Up to Bendigo.
Yes.
At Bendigo, there's the sort of newish development out at White Hills on the north side of town, which I'll be at on Wednesday this week.
Excellent. What's that for?
It's a Victorian Botanic Gardens Network meeting. So it's the Victorian branch of BGANZ, and we're having a day there with presentations and things, and I'm having a bit of a chat.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. Excellent. That's fantastic to hear. Greg, I've got a question specifically for you, but it's open. So Deb from North Croydon's texted in and said, question for Greg. I have heaps of stinkhorn fungi that have appeared this year. Should I be concerned and should I do anything about them?
I'd be really happy.
Good.
Because
that's great.
The stinkhorns are recycling fungi, so they're saprotrophs and are basically eating organic matter and turning it into nice healthy soil. So stinkhorns were one thing that And they look amazing too. When she says stinkhorns, I'm not sure if it's the Asaro rubra, which is one of our native species, which look like a red sea anemone, but also like an animal's bottom a little bit with a bit of poo smeared on it.
Great.
Well, they're fly attractors, so they're basically they're mimicking an animal's bottom, really. So flies come around and land in what looks like poo, but it's actually spores, and then they carry it around and land on a wombat poo or something, and off it all goes again.
They've worked out the transport system.
Yeah, so the Asaro rubras are really amazing looking things. The other stinkhorns are Clathrus archeri, is probably another common one, which looks similar.
Yep.
There's cage fungi as well.
Yes.
Which had are them around in the that sort of area.
They look pretty amazing.
Yeah. So just enjoy the show. But they're making soil. Yeah, they're rotting stuff down, making soil.
While they're present, what should gardeners do around them? Like in the sense of not disturbing the soil, putting extra organic matter in. Is there anything in that context?
Well, I think to
continue to support them?
Even what we were talking about earlier with the malaria and whatever, part of keeping things healthy is keeping the fungi and the soil healthy.
Yep.
So, yeah, if you've got, if there's any way you can not take any green matter off your property and you can incorporate all of that green matter back into your garden, I'd do that.
Yeah, great.
And those types of fungi are the ones that will break it down and make your soil healthier.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Very good.
That's interesting what you're saying, Greg, actually. That after spending a day with Fergus Garrett a couple of years back, we literally dashed back to our B&B and emailed the young bloke who was beginning work on the bottom half of the property, collecting the debris from the old Woolwich nursery site, and he was generating truckloads of this stuff. So I just emailed and said, well, leave it on site, tuck it away as best you can. Hide it as best you can, and if you can't hide it, then make it look ornamental. So that's what he's done. So Michael's been flat out for 2 years now doing exactly that.
Yeah.
Now, one thing, though, I noticed there was on social media that, going back to Troy Scott Smith in Sissinghurst, they have the same problem with the debris generated by the garden. And he was using a mix of, he was actually adding fungal spores to these piles of debris. So what are your feelings about that?
I'd say that the air is pretty much full of fungal spores. So if you've got dead organic material, they've been doing it for longer than animals have been on land. Yep. Okay. and they're pretty good at finding food. But it doesn't hurt, does it? Like, especially if you want to encourage.
Well, I'm just wondering whether you're altering the original mix of funguses by doing that.
Well, I guess you could be, yeah. But most of the, so if you're looking at wood chips, for instance, in Victoria, there's three or four main species of fungi that you'll find in wood chips of pretty much any kind, really.
Yeah.
And they all do the same job. They'll find, you know, you spread wood chips on a garden, you'll get fungi in it. It just depends which of those, one of those four main, or you might get all of those four plus some other ones. There's probably a heap more species that are just like little brown mushrooms that, you know, only mycologists can tell apart.
Well, it's interesting just on that, because having worked with the mycologists at Kew, they estimate that they probably have identified maybe between 5 and 10% of what might exist in the world of fungi, which would be...
5 to 10%.
Yeah, which would be millions of things that are yet to be identified.
Wow.
And the potential of all that in a whole range of ways that are beneficial or and sometimes not, but... it's almost like the torch is now being shined on
we're at the tip of the iceberg, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas higher plants and things like that, there are something like 1,200 odd new species discovered every year worldwide, but that's just in the margin. So mostly people know what exists, and it's about 400,000 odd. I can't remember the exact number of species of plant, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to the number of species of fungi.
You got to remember too what I'm talking about anyway are the fungi that you can see.
Yeah.
So the stinkhorns that you know these weird things that you find on a pile of old garden waste or whatever. A lot of the fungi in the soil we don't see.
No.
There is no mushroom that comes up because that's what we're looking at as people. That's what they're the bits that we're looking for are the mushrooms. So there's my community, Applied Mycology, which is like a lab that does a lot of mycology. They were trying to develop a test, basically sequencing all the DNA for these different species of fungi so you can find out what's in the soil just by taking a soil test, not by going, oh, there's a mushroom, there's a mushroom, there's a mushroom. It's like you take a sample from the soil, and in that sample, hopefully, if they've got all the DNA sequences for what's in there, and they'll give you a list of all the fungi that are in that area, and what they're what sort type of fungi, whether they're mycorrhizal or saprotrophs or parasitics,
which they can only do if they've already sequenced
exactly.
So and that's the thing. There's a whole lot, and sequencing has become much quicker and much more much less expensive than it used to be. So all of that is accelerating for vascular plants as well. It's mostly done on DNA, which is a little bit of a problem for the field botanist.
It is a bit.
We sort of get left behind.
But it's an extra tool. Too, it is as well that we can make some use of. Yeah,
and the talk has been for a few years about the handheld device that allows you to put a little sample of a plant or something else on it, and it will match that up against the data bank of DNA sequences and tell you what it is, sort of as an alternative route to identifying a plant.
Yeah,
but then it hasn't sort of got there yet. I think that the hardware exists, but it's the data. And how you handle that massive bank of data of DNA sequences to inform your decision. Bearing in mind that the living organism with the biggest volume of DNA base pairs is actually a fork fern from New Caledonia, Mazipterus, one of the Mazipteruses, which has something like 20 times or more the volume of base pairs than humans do. In fact, 100 times more. It's just ludicrous. So
wait till you get into the sex life of fungi, because they have more than two.
Right, this is
five. I think there's one species that they've said about 26 or more. No, it's more than that. It's really confusing because it's just completely different to what we're used to. With, as you say, what we see with our eyes, you can... most of us can look at a plant, and even if we don't know what it is, we can go, oh, it might be in that family, or it looks like it came from here, or it might be a desert plant, or, you can, but...
There's so much more in the world that we can't see.
That's right. And it's all there for a reason, and it's all part of the diversity that we were talking about earlier, and it all does a job, and when it's knocked out of balance, that's when you get problems.
Correct.
So going back to the stinkhorns, feed them.
Feed them,
feed everything else in there, keep your soil healthy.
Good.
Try and get as much as you can out of your own garden back into the soil there, because that's what makes the plants healthy, spraying it with pesticide and fungicide and putting petrochemical fertilisers on it all the time.
Yes. So Jill from Croydon's messaged in saying she's essentially done that by, in her terms, a lot of chop and drop. Is that she's excited because she's found a large number of ruby buttons this past last week in the area where she does a lot of chop and drop.
Mm-hmm.
So she's feeding the soil and they're loving it.
Another little wood rotting species.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've got another question that's come through on the text from David in Upway. Speaking about Hemanthus albifloss, looking for advice that's in the ground. Looking for advice to divide and plant. It is to go into the ground. Wanting to divide and plant, wanting to know what conditions they like.
I've always had, if you want more of them, I've always had a really good time up in Romsey with Elberfloss in the shade.
Yes.
Doesn't flower as much, but you can turn one bulb into about 30 in about 5 years' time.
Right.
They do divide very well in the shade.
Preference for dividing.
Yep.
Multiplying is shade.
Multiplying, I'd go the shadier. As I say, they don't flower so good, but they do multiply really well in the shade.
But otherwise, from a flowering point of view, part shade?
Bit more sun.
Bit more sun?
Yep.
Excellent.
Fairly free-draining soil.
Yes.
I've got a pot or two of them in at the hospital garden where I am, and I keep looking at them each year and going, oh, yes, I need to put them in the ground. But they're flowering beautifully. Tough. There's no love necessarily given to them in the 8-inch squat pot that they're in. They're pretty tight in the pot. And I was just looking at them last week and I was like, oh, aren't you wonderful?
Mm.
You're just doing your thing without me.
A lot of those are.
And that was shade, but also neglect.
Yeah, a lot of those amaryllis type bulbs love being confined in a small pot with 30,000 of their nearest of kin. They seem to do a lot better.
Very good, very good. So, it's nice to know a bit of sun for them for flower.
They're not a big fan of frost and things, I don't think, the Elberfloss, because it's essentially evergreen.
Yes.
It's not one like the cochineus. That'll die down during summer and the big, grow through winter. That's the elephant ear.
Yep, the red flowering one.
So the Elberfloss is on the evergreen side. I don't think they take so well to really cold, harsh stuff. I think they're maybe from slightly more in the tropics than the cochineas. Bit of sun, a bit of sort of protection from really cold stuff, and well-drained soil, I think, is another thing too. And neglect. They do come from pretty harsh places, a lot of those
pots
and things, yeah.
So excellent. Now, we also have another one come in, a message from Adri, who is wanting to know when the right time to transplant a Pachynum Triumph pear from a pot into the ground. The right time to transplant, I would be saying you'd be looking at the right time now, heading into...
About 3 weeks ago, wasn't it?
While the soil is still got a bit of warmth in it, but not totally deciduous.
Yeah, might as well do it now.
Yeah.
I think certainly the soil warmth would help, and probably any time from now through to November. Ideally you wouldn't whack it in the ground if you're heading into searing dry heat, but
correct,
you know, autumn through winter and into early spring.
Excellent. Yes, fine. It's always a good time when it's less stressed to get it in and get it established, so that then come spring it's the new shoot, the new roots that present before the shoots pop out.
And I'm often reminded that, you know, we have our, well, not necessarily rules, but we say you have to do this then and that. But actually, sometimes you just do it when you can, and you'd be surprised how often things are done at exactly the opposite time of year when you're recommended to do them, and it goes perfectly well. And the precedent, well, not the precedent, but William Guilfoyle, you know, master landscape designer, gardener, the guiding hand behind the development of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne and many other gardens in Victoria, moved fully grown trees year round and lost very few of them. So, I think, you know, as I said, we have our sort of semi-rules and this and that, and by and large they're based in good sense, but sometimes actually you can just go ahead and do something, and if you look after it a bit, it'll be fine.
And that's the thing, I think, moving a large tree you can do at any time if you've got the support to look after it once you've changed it, i.e. watering, management, all those sort of aspects. So that's reassuring for all those gardeners out there that happen to buy plants and leave them in pots for a little bit longer than they should.
Yeah.
You can still put them in the ground at any time of the year.
One of the stories I enjoyed about William Guilfoyle was that one of the trees he moved was an oak, and I think from memory it was a black oak or something, but he shifted it from, because he shifted, you know, he remodeled the entire site over the 37 years he was director, but he'd shifted this tree and it sat there looking miserable and it was, you know, it was in decline and this and that, because he didn't like to be associated with a failure of anything. So he asked the staff to sort of cut it off just below ground level and cover over the stump, which they did, whereupon it shot back to life, and whereupon he said, well, of course, that's how you treat a black oak, you know.
Very, yeah, okay, very good recovery there, very good recovery.
I've heard of someone who moved a collection of magnolias, and magnolias resent root disturbance.
Yes.
By doing the same thing, by chopping them back to a stump and moving the stumps.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, 15, 20-year-old magnolias.
Right.
Yes, one of the old nursery people who'd come across this story somewhere, and just about all of them survived.
That's very successful.
Yeah.
Very successful. So, in essence, give things a go.
Yeah.
Within reason.
And everything won't work.
No, that's...
But that's the nature of gardening, isn't
it? Well, like you can say, you can do everything by the book and fail, and then you can try and do something with what you've been given, and it's quite a success, you know, without any sort of one telling you that it will be.
Yes. Now, Richard, someone's texted in and asked a very good question. You might, this might be hard for you to answer, though. Well, they've given you a broad aspect, okay, which is good. So what are some of your favourite botanic gardens in Victoria and Australia? Is what we're after.
Goodness.
Not the best, and so you don't have to worry about being putting anyone out of...
Well, look, I mean, we have, you know, the big Melbourne and Cranbourne are the biggest and best resourced, and they are both interesting and wonderful gardens. I particularly like some of our smaller botanic gardens in, you know, across the regions of Victoria. I guess one of my favourites is the Camperdown Botanic Garden.
Yes.
Sits up on top of that you know, botanic volcanic hill, and over the last decade or so, the friends of the Camperdown Botanic Gardens and Arboretum have done fabulous work, sort of renewing the planting, improving the planting, and just lifting the quality of it.
They have
really significantly.
Been following along with that one as well, and see the amazing energy and work that's put into it. I know there's a challenging aspect there, not just with location, but what else is on that around that site?
The caravan park. Call it what it is. Yes. But you know, so I'm really, I mean, that's one of my favourite. And just, it's not just the garden itself, but the aspects of it. Yep. You know, the look, the views you have across the Western Plains, you know, those volcanic plains. It's quite extraordinary. So I really love that one. You know, as I said, there are, across the state, there are, because we have such varied growing conditions, we have hugely varied gardens, and but I really like just popping into some of those smaller ones and some of the older, because you'll find specimens of trees planted in 1860 or which is, you know,
still rare or something. Like, oh wow, I haven't seen one of those.
And it'll be because Baron von Mueller sent the seed out to someone and they said, well, let's give this a go. Extraordinary.
Yeah, very.
So I've skirted around the question there. Yeah,
no, that's all right. No, there was the range that was there with some, so you don't have to be very specific.
But, I mean, again, the thing I would say is for anyone, well, either living in a town that has a botanic garden, go and make use of it, you know, enjoy what's there.
Yeah.
But also if you're living in Melbourne somewhere and you want to go for a day out, just have a look at where some of those gardens are, and you can sort of call into three or four in a day and just have an enriching experience.
Well, you're right. I mean, I meander down through the botanic gardens in Melbourne here often. And it's, you know, I'm a plant person, so I'm looking at the plants. But I'm also quite enjoy seeing the people that are using it. Like, it's wonderful to walk through and go, there's a group over there that are having a family gathering, a party, a couple over there having a picnic. A diversity of people use them and engage with them.
And often the garden itself.
That may not be planty people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And love spending time in them.
And the garden is a sort of medium for that social connection, isn't it? Whether it's within the family or within between groups or what have you. I remember David Churchill, who was director of the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne from the 70s through the 80s, saying that he would often observe families coming in arguing on the way in and heading out laughing. And,
gosh, and that's a good response.
It may not have been true the whole time, to be perfectly frank. But
nothing like embellishing a story. But I can understand, you know, coming back to the point about health and, you know, being in environments like that change.
And change
us in a positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a mountain of evidence for that. You know, it's well documented.
Correct.
You know, mental health, physical health, being in green environments, whether they're gardens or whether they're natural environments. Yep. And in fact, there's a very good book called Good Nature, written by Professor Kathy Willis, who I worked with at Kew, and she's a professor at Oxford University. And it goes through all the data and all the research of what the, you know, what's going on in the body, what chemical things are happening that actually mean that you prefer a certain density of trees to another density. You know, there's a certain sweet spot and colours and mixtures of colours. Really interesting book, and easy to read through too.
Excellent. So that's Good Nature.
Good Nature.
Yep.
And just the other thing to say, I mean, we're so lucky here because most of our botanic gardens are free entry.
True. Yes.
It's not the case everywhere in the world. And I can tell you the entry to the Royal Botanic Gardens queue, I was somewhat surprised when, you know, having been away for a year, I think it's now full price is close to £30 to get in.
Wow. Okay.
So $60-odd per person.
That's a conscious decision.
That's slightly startling, because I remember staying with my sister just around the corner from the main entrance in 1973, and the entrance fee at that point was one penny.
which I presume
dated from Queen Victoria's time.
Well, almost. It all changed when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister, because she decided the user had to pay.
But, surprise, surprise.
But it's no surprise also that many of the local members, because people take out a membership so they don't pay the gate fee, but they constantly would remind us of when it was a penny to get in almost every day. So.
Well, I was there for 2 or 3 months that visit and went in quite a few times because it was so close. And I looked at the guy collecting the pennies and thinking, do you get enough to pay your wages?
Probably not.
But speaking of visiting gardens, you know, there's gardens galore to visit. So I know that for each of you here, with Forest Glade, that's open to the public?
Mm-hmm. Every day, yeah.
Every day, so seven days a week?
Yep.
Except for
Christmas fire band days or total fire band days, yep.
And Cloud Hill is also open?
Yes, yeah.
7 days?
7 days, closed for about 2 or 3 days a year.
Yep. Mm. So, you know, I encourage everyone to get out into gardens, whether you need to pay to get into them or whether they're free, they are worth it. There's so much in them and so much goes into them to create those spaces and, you know, rich, diverse of plantings, amazing staff that work them and keep them so that they are sustained, but also there for everyone to enjoy.
And also there's that, you know, the marvellous range of gardens that are privately owned again and are open through different garden schemes.
Correct, with Open Gardens Victoria.
And you know, those are often, you know, they don't have staff except for the owners themselves.
Yeah.
But it's just incredibly generous of those people to open the gate and share the garden with the visitor.
We could do this with any gardens, but with Open Gardens Victoria, I often sit and get onto the website. It used to be the book years ago, but now it's the website, so it's updated a lot more frequently and easily. Mm. But you'd sit there and go, right, if I don't put these in my diary, like I look through them and go, well, that one's interesting, I want to put that. I consciously put them into my diary because otherwise it'll come up and I'll go, oh, that would have been good to see, but I've got something else on. But as opposed to going, no, I want to see that, so I'm going to put it in the diary first. Because I was on the OGV website recently and, you know, they've got gardens there for spring already that are starting to be populated onto that. So it's good to plan ahead so not only will you be looking up what botanic gardens are around, not just for next week, for Began's week and month, but also for throughout the year and going, right, what are some gardens? So maybe in this overwintering period when people are sort of getting inside a bit cosy. Maybe it's time to check out, do some research about gardens to see in spring and summer and next year's autumn.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, map it out.
You've got a book there, Francis?
I had no idea that Richard was going to be here today, but just by coincidence, last 2 minutes, I grabbed a couple of books from our bookshelves by Rika Erickson.
Yep, they look like they've been well read.
It was a naturalist, they're dating from the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Yes.
She was a naturalist in the original sense of the term. And she lived just near where we farmed, actually. She lived at Bolgart, and we were in the same shire.
Yep.
And in fact, one of the books is her trigger plants book, which is reasonably well known amongst people who collect these sort of things, because it was published in 1958, and it was the first serious monograph on trigger plants. But then she went on to became interested in history and wrote a number of books on history, including The Drummonds of Hawthornden, the interesting thing about The Drummonds of Hawthornden is the James Drummond, the original Drummond, was the botanist who did a huge amount of work in Western Australia collecting botanical specimens and sending them to the original. James Drummond was a really good friend of Kew Gardens' original director. And I'm trying to think which Hooker it was. There were two Hookers.
William Hooker.
Hooker. Yeah. They were in correspondence for years and constantly sending letters backwards and forwards.
Yep.
And so James, he literally arrives with the first boat to the first settlement in 1829 in Fremantle. And a slightly tricky settlement, Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
There was Stirling who got this whole thing going, explored the Swan a couple of years earlier and spent about 4 or 5 days and somehow managed to only ever step off the river onto silt soils and didn't notice that it was 95% sand. So he sends off these letters all around the world saying, fabulous soils in Western Australia, come along. We'll be settling there in 2 years' time. And so all these people arrive, including James Drummond, expecting to set up farms and discover there's no soil.
Whoops.
Big shock.
Yep.
In fact, one of the families who arrived were the Henty family. And they were so stunned that they hunted around for 2 or 3 years and eventually purchased a fairly considerable vessel for themselves and sailed to Tasmania, dropped in on the Victorian coast on the way through and spotted, something that looks like agricultural soils, and came back 2 years later. But the Hentys actually started off in Western Australia.
Right.
So that's why settlement in Western Australia was so incredibly slow. No soil. So what was James to do with his life? Well, he'd moved there with his entire family. And the only way, he always had an interest in botany, so he set about making himself the colony's botanist. And over a period of 15 years, he botanised every single valley system in Western Australia, sending seed and also botanical specimens to Kew Gardens. So one of the big collections of botanical specimens in the Kew Gardens Herbarium is James Drummond's. And I might say his personal collection ended up in the Melbourne Herbarium. So those two collections are absolutely pivotal to understanding Western Australian plants.
So why did they go to the Melbourne Herbarium and not the Perth Herbarium?
Melbourne was why are they? You're talking about botanical gardens. There's really just one botanical garden in Western Australia, and that's Kings Park.
But there's the herbarium.
Yeah, there is, but the Melbourne was much more prestigious.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, the story of the Drummonds is just unbelievable.
Right.
And it also includes James Drummond's sons. And, well, I can spend an hour or two on it.
But we're not
you can make a movie on their life. You literally could make a movie.
Right.
And because, I mean, this guy was travelling around towards the end of his... He was in his 60s and 70s and heading off into the bush with a pack horse and travelling through country, of course, trespassing everywhere.
Mm.
There were a lot of spearings in those days, and the word got out that the Drummonds were one of the few families that actually got along reasonably well with the local people, with the Noongar people.
Yeah,
John Drummond's James Drummond's son John spoke several Aboriginal languages. He actually accompanied his father on a collecting trip to somewhere north of Geraldton. At a time when the local people, the Yamatji people, were aware of what was going on in the southwest, and they were attacked at the end of one afternoon. And apparently the story goes that they'd been travelling all day. They'd built a mya to camp in for the evening, and they just got this thing up, and suddenly there were spears, and there were 14, 15 people hurling spears at them. And so James Drummond stayed in the Maya Maya, and John Drummond's response to this attack was to step outside and tear his shirt off and dodge the spears.
Right.
Now, have you ever come across this before? This is a tradition right across Australia, spear dodging.
Right.
But it hardly ever involved Europeans. It generally involved Aboriginal people, and was how disputes were settled. This John Drummond was familiar enough with the local culture to know this is how you settle a dispute. You expose yourself and you yell abuse at whoever it is that's chucking spears at you, and then you dodge them.
Right.
And the idea is to dodge them, allow them to come as close as possible. You know, that's why they had shields which were very, very narrow. So the idea was actually to touch the spears that went past. Now, those spears were deadly accurate. this was quite something.
Yeah.
Anyway, they survived, and that settled the dispute. The warriors sort of headed back into the bush, and they carried on with their botanizing. But this sort of thing was happening.
Yeah.
As I said, you could make a movie about the lives of the Drummonds.
Yeah, there's a retirement job for you. Well, you are listening to the 3CR Garden Show. My name's Stephen Wells. In the studio, we have Greg Balderston, Jeremy Francis, and Richard Barley. It's great to have you all here. I would just love to invite listeners again to, if you've got a question or something you want to chat with us about, to give us a call. Our number is 94190155, or text in 0488 809 855. We've got some community announcements I'd love to get to. Last week we mentioned about the series Olives to Oil, so just a reminder that that's actually going through for the continuation of this month, which is great. We've also got talk by Penny Woodward, one of our wonderful panellists, on how to grow and use herbs for cooking, medicine and pleasure. So that's going to be held in Prahran at the Prahran Mechanics Institute, Victorian History Library. That date is the 26th of May. It's a Tuesday. It's during the day between 2 and 3 p.m. So you can sort tickets on that by going to the Prahran Mechanics Institute website, which is pmi.net.au. We've also got a talk coming up on the 30th of May. It's hosted by the Australian Plant Society. It's an illustrated talk called Creating Pollinator-Friendly Nature Strips. That's with Emma Cutting, who's doing great work in that space. So Saturday, 30th of May, it's in the afternoon. Similarly, you can probably look up, it's a bit of a long, the tickets for that are through the Humanitix linkage, but if you look up the Australian Plant Society and Emma Cutting's talk for that day. That would be great. And just a reminder too that we have our 3CR Radiothon coming up at the end of June, so just be prepared for that. It's a great time to support the station. I've also got in here that Burnley Gardens are having their open day, so it's a free entry. It's the 24th of May, so that's coming up next weekend. Between 10 and 3, there's plant sales, guided garden tours, open art studio, and there's also some the Swinburne Chorale playing at 11 a.m. So plants to buy, food to have, gardens to enjoy. Lots to see and lots to still happening at this time of the year, which is fantastic. I want to come back to you, Richard, and ask before we go to another question that's just come in. Are there particular events that are coming up that that you want to specifically highlight? I know there's lots happening, and getting people out to the getting connected to the Began's website is the best way to find out.
But yeah, I think that's the thing, is because there are some webinars and this and that, some talks, and there's a full list of activities, as I said, right across the country. So
excellent.
Without picking out any...
No, I'm not going to get you to be biased.
But that's the thing, is to go and look at the BGANZ website. Just Google that and it'll take you to the list of activities. And
brilliant.
Go with it that way, I think.
Excellent. Fantastic. So we've got a text message that's come in. Someone who has an established fruiting pear tree. It's about 8 metres tall, with a stem that's probably about 30 centimetres in diameter. It naturally has grown in an upright column-like structure, similar to the Capital variety. It fruits a fair bit, but the local parrot munch on all the fruit. That's not the question, it's okay, which is fine. The question is, my yard in this spot is kind of sloped, and I'm wanting to tier it with a couple of layers of retaining walls. The proposed retaining wall would be on one side, approximately 2.7 metres away from the pyrus. I'm wondering if this would be safe enough distance away from the tree. So essentially wanting to protect the root zone, knowing that that root zone could probably be quite diverse, as in quite broad. What are people's thoughts on retaining walls in a well-established tree?
2.7 metres.
Yeah, it'll be about...
It's a bit of a space, isn't it?
And it's not a huge tree by the sound of it. It's
8 metres,
but yeah, that's not... It's not a 300-year-old oak tree or eucalyptus obliqua, which 2.7 metres might be a bit close for a tree like that.
True, yep.
But I think for a Chanticleer or an upright type pear...
Yep.
And if you're doing it at the right time of the year and making sure that if you do cut through any of the larger roots to make sure that they're cut cleanly...
Yes, good point.
And the tree itself's looked after. I think you should. I mean, it's not great for the tree, but it should survive it fairly easily. I would have thought. Yeah,
excellent.
Yeah, I would have thought it was okay. We've done similar things ourselves as we're constructing Cloud Hill.
Yep.
Those dimensions, 2.7 metres, is most probably as close as you would want to go. You could spread the stress of the tree by doing it over two seasons, cutting half the roots one season and then finishing it off the next season and then building your wall. But I think you'd be moderately safe.
Yeah, good. Good.
And I guess the other question is there just one terrace or one retaining wall, or is there another one on the other side? So
that's not in the details.
Is it one side only?
Might be... I'm making an assumption here. Sloped site, retaining wall at the bottom side, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. So long as it's just one side, yeah.
Yeah,
and yeah, watch around the... Like if you build up dirt around an existing tree too much, that can cause some issues as well.
Yeah. Yep.
So if the tree's lower down and the terrace is going to be higher than the original ground level for the tree, you might run into some issues there with crown rots and different things as well.
So you wouldn't want to be adding soil depth to the root zone of the tree up to the 2.7 metres where the retaining wall will be constructed.
No. So essentially my understanding of that is that it's more about the retaining wall going in at that 2.7 away from the base of the tree.
Yep.
Yeah, so good.
Leave the rest of the root system alone.
Yeah, excellent. Mm. Very good. Now, David from Upway has messaged in to say, how can we volunteer to be involved in the radiothon coming up? David, what I'd encourage you to do is ring into the station at the moment, and our wonderful producers will be able to chat with you and guide you on that. If you can't call in now, maybe you can email us during the course of the week as well. So that would be wonderful. Thank you so much for offering to volunteer. This is community radio, and volunteering is what we all do, so it's great to have that interest.
And the producers are there waiting for the call, aren't they?
You can see them. They can see them through the window.
They're poised.
Thumbs up, waiting for you, David. Excellent. Now, we've also got another question come in. Morning all, great public gardens discussion. A friend recently asked my advice regarding a small neglected tree, approximately 3 metres high in their old overgrown garden. From the remaining few autumn colours, it looks like it's a dogwood. It is growing in a complete shade, surrounded by other trees. They asked my help as to how to prune it and revive it. I know nothing about dogwoods and would appreciate your advice. Any thoughts about dogwoods? So 3 metres high, so it sounds like it's been there for a little while, but amongst a whole lot of other trees.
And depending on the species, because a number of them are understory species, so that naturally they grow under canopies of other trees. But it does depend a little what it is. And and if all the woody material is live, or is it partly dead? Or
That's not come through, but essentially wanting to know what to do with pruning and or revive, like to.
So if it was an understory tree, one of the things you could do is lift up the bigger trees around it to give it a bit more room, because being an understory tree doesn't necessarily mean that the bigger tree's growing down into it and squishing it.
So you
to separate the canopy a little bit might be really helpful if it is an understory tree. If it's not an understory tree, it's not looking good for it, because unless you want to take down the big trees, which I would
at least half like, surely. And pruning the surrounding vegetation to allow a bit more light through would be
number one,
and then removing any dead wood. Yes. 3 metres doesn't sound, it sounds as though it's unhappy.
Mm. Yeah. So, a bit of light pruning, formative pruning to keep shape, but maybe also then see what's happening in the soil in regards to feeding, giving that a bit of extra nutrients.
Yep.
Excellent. Very good. That is a very good segue into, I noticed that a couple of you have brought in some wonderful offerings.
I have,
I know that Greg did.
I've definitely, so I think I was on a couple of weeks ago and was asked what my favourite autumn trees were.
Excellent.
By John,
what
I think.
What hits that category
and
for
one,
you?
One of them is always the Lindera, Lindera obtusiloba, which I've bought in. Probably one of my favourite yellow autumn colours.
Yes.
And yellow can be a bit boring in autumn because it often tends to a brownish colour in a lot of cases, and can be a bit like,
the obtusifolia is an orange yellow. We've got one in colour right now.
Yeah.
And it's very striking.
Yeah.
It's much more so than the reds.
Yes. Yeah. So I found with mine, the leaves that are exposed to the sun are on the warm side of yellow. So they're this beautiful orange. They have orange splashes in it, but on the beautiful warm side of yellow.
Yes.
But on the lower leaves, which is the branch I picked off, was actually one of the understory leaves that I was going to walk into, so I thought I might as well pick that one. they're a beautiful, cool, clear yellow, where the sun doesn't hit them so much. So you can also see the buds forming on here, which are the flower buds, which happen in late winter.
Yep.
Nothing terribly exciting. They're sort of just little green dangly bits hanging off the branches, essentially. But
so not showy. Nothing.
Not particularly. Okay. No.
How tall was this one again?
So this would be 4 meters, I think. Yep. And it's about 25 years old.
Great.
Lindera. Lindera. It's Lindera. I think they're related to bay. I think they're in the bay family or whatever that is.
Yes. Very good.
And they're a bit hard to get. I think Stephen, Stephen and Craig,
Yamina,
Dixonia.
I'm interested with it too because I'm looking at it here, and we'll take photos of it. Two different distinct. There are distinctively different leaf shapes.
Yes. They can be three.
Yeah.
Yes, yep. Oval leaves, then you get...
So the juvenile leaves are elliptical,
yes,
sort of chordate sort of almost shaped leaves. Mm. And then the biggest healthy leaves are like trilobed at the top, similar to a tulip tree type leaf, I guess, in some ways, except three lobes instead of the two sort of lobes on they have in the middle. And then, yeah, you can almost see the two or three different shape leaves that they can get on them. But just beautiful autumn colour, just a lovely shaped, small, beautiful yellow autumn tree.
Nice.
And nice the other times of the year as well.
Yep.
So I've loved those for years. And at some point I saw someone selling some other species of Lindera and just bought them not knowing what the trees were. I think I lost one, but one of the other ones that survived was Lindera angustifolia, which has got a very lance-shaped leaf, smaller leaf. I think most of the Linderas, is it dioecious, where they've male and female separate trees?
Yes.
So the Lindera obtusa loba that was introduced into Australia, I believe is a female, is one of the female forms. And my friend Finn from Autumn Joy Nurseries managed to get some seeds of it, so he's now got male and female plants growing.
Great.
And he'd be a good one too if you're ever after it up at Newbury, in Autumn Joy Nursery in Newbury.
Excellent.
Anyway, so I've got this Lindera angustifolia, and it happens to be a female. And because I've got – actually, no, this would be a male because my angustifolia gets seed on it. I think it's pollinated off my Lindera obtusa loba.
So you could have an interesting hybrid.
I could do, there. Yeah. Mm. So angustifolia has got these small lance-shaped leaves, tends to be more on the orange side.
Okay.
And I think in certain areas I've seen it like beautifully fiery orange and almost red. But it does tend, for me, it tends to be more yellow with some orange flushes through it for the autumn colour. The leaves do cling onto it after they've finished colouring, so you get brown leaves on there that'll hang on for quite a few months.
Yeah, kind of fun.
Yeah, I don't mind that. Yeah, I mean, for certain things. Yeah,
there's quite a few trees to it, that angustifolia that really hangs onto its old leaves.
Yep.
But it also has these little tiny blackberries that persist for quite a long time too.
Right.
So at the moment, I've got this tree with beautiful yellow, orange flush autumn colour, with pea-sized black berries all the way through the tree, and it's got quite a lot of them. It gets a lot of berries on it.
Yes.
Just a nice little tree. It's nothing particularly flashy or showy or anything like that. Just a not nice autumn colour.
Not everything beautiful needs to black be berries. Showy.
Yeah, yeah.
Do the seeds spread around at all? Do they come
They up? Don't germinate in the garden.
Okay.
But I have collected some, and I think... I gave them to Finn at Autumn Joy, but I'm pretty sure he handed them on to Don Teeks. So I'm not sure if Don's got any of them growing, but they seem viable. Like they've got the solid seeds inside the seeds, inside the pods.
I've not seen any seedlings.
Yeah, there's certainly none have popped up underneath. It's not going to be a weed species, put it that way.
Good. Very good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And the other plant that I bought in is a climber, and it's in the grape family. It's Ampelopsis brevipedunculatus.
Yes. I think it's
catchy name.
It might be brevipedunculata. I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Yep.
Porcelain berries, one of the common names, and it's as vigorous as a grape. You wouldn't want to put it on something small.
Okay.
It's a real thug. But at this time of the year, so it pretty much just looks like a grape for most of the year.
Yes.
At this time of the year, the leaves go beautiful, soft, buttery yellow. Nice. So it's not a particularly strong autumn colour, but it's a nice, even, clear colour.
Yep.
But the features, the berries it has on it, so being in the grape family, it has these little clusters of fruit on the stems of the climber that sort of start off a green colour, then they promote themselves to blue, and then they finally end up purple.
Yep.
And they're very striking, there. And they're sort of porcelain blue, porcelain purple, sort of colours. So the berries on them are quite the feature at this time of the year. And I think they're edible too, although they don't taste very good.
Now, is that a lived experience you've tasted?
It's like
you're still
eating,
alive.
Eating a grape that where the seeds are 90% of the fruit.
Yeah. All
right. Yeah. And grape seeds don't taste great either. If you bite it, if you accidentally bite into the seed, it's just bitter.
Good. Now, what you've brought in is, I can only just see one tiny bit turning yellow. So it is still predominantly green at this time. At so it's holding its...
Yeah. Like I say, at home... I remember just a couple of nights ago at 11, 12 o'clock at night, it was like a summer's night. It was sort of warm northerly winds at nearly midnight. So it's really not that cold at home. We've had a couple of cold nights, but not.
Yeah. Are you finding that same too, Jeremy, with up in the Mount
Dandenong? Really uncanny walking around in summer gear in this stage of May. We're getting a little burst of cool weather every few days, but what are the plants going to be thinking about all this in another 5-10 years? Poof.
This time last year, though, I recall because we'd just arrived in Melbourne in early May, and there was a week or two of shorts weather. Of sunny days, and we thought, hello.
And then what have we come back to?
Just when you get sort of casual and relaxed, then the weather turns. So
And you, then
it all swings around. Yeah. Bang.
You're pulling out the scarves, the beanie, and the thick jackets.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Certainly in Woodend.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, quick question for you, Richard. I'm interested with you've had quite an extensive journey with what your work and your roles. Where did it? What started it? What got you into horticulture to start with?
Oh, interesting question. I suppose, as with many people who work in horticulture, in your childhood, you dabble with this and that. So I dabbled when I was a young child, and then I pursued various other things. I thought I'd work in agriculture.
Yeah.
I thought I wanted to do wool classing. Actually, that was the career for me, which I decided then not to do, But skipping over several chapters, I applied for a job at the Botanic Gardens in early 1980, and it was to do 8 weeks' work.
Yeah.
And it was going out into the bush. It was doing vegetation survey and that sort of thing. And I knew a thing or two about plants and about getting around in the bush and whatnot. So I applied for the job. I didn't get it. And then I thought, well, I'm not doing anything. I'll volunteer and, so I went and I started doing the work on a volunteer basis. And then after a few days, the person who got the job then didn't turn up. And so I got that job.
Right.
And that 8 weeks turned into 16, and that turned into a couple of years, and things went on from there. And then, again, David Churchill, who was director of the Botanic Gardens, I think he took a sort of fatherly view of people like myself who clearly needed a little bit of steerage from time to time. And we discussed studying horticulture at Burnley.
Yep.
And he said, well, Burnley are just introducing the new degree course. This was 1986. Don't go there. Don't apply for it this year. Wait a year until the bugs have been knocked out and apply for the following year, which I did, and I was lucky to get into that. And I kept working on a few things at the Botanic Gardens at the same time. Did the course, which at the time was a fantastic horticulture course. It was, it had people like James Hitchmore, Peter May, Greg Moore, all sorts of really knowledgeable people teaching. And from that, I was just lucky to get a job back at the Botanic Gardens, working on regional Botanic Gardens, amongst other things, significant trees and this and that. And then one thing led to another, and I finished up in charge of the Melbourne site.
Yep.
And But the salient thing about it is that course, the degree course in applied science horticulture, doesn't exist anymore.
No.
And it is such a yawning gap in the sort of education and training world, not only here but overseas also.
Yeah.
You can just see as we go along, year on year, that there are fewer and fewer people who've actually had that sort of education and have the sort of scientific grounding to do a lot of the work that is actually needed to be done,
yep.
particularly in terms of the changing climate and this and that. So one of my real things about being back is we somehow have to actually rebuild some of what was sort of dismantled and withered on the vine in terms of that horticultural training that sits above TAFE,
yeah.
you know, that allows people to really get their teeth into why things happen. You know, why do you do this to a plant? Not just what do you do, why do you do it? And why do you do it at this time of year? You know, what's going on in the plant and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, good.
So that's, you know, I'm really passionate about trying to find ways to support better horticultural education within Australia.
I think that's great to hear and to know, because I went through Burnley and did the diploma, the two-year course through there, going back 2000, 2001, and it was a changing landscape then, and following in the years following that, and it's a worry with looking at, I remember hearing the discussions around that time that it was, you know, what was happening there was also happening around the world, so yeah. it's a worldwide sort of change, which is a worrying thing. So
it is, and in the UK, a lot of the courses have closed down that taught horticulture, like Wye College and places like that. Yep. At Kew, we had our own School of Horticulture, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So we ran the 3-year Kew diploma in botanical horticulture and various other apprenticeships, 12-month courses and things, and those graduates are just snapped up, you know, yeah. even before they graduate, that they know where they're going, because it's such a hungry market for people who have that sort of understanding, not just of sort of traditional horticulture, but habitats, ecology, you know, pathology, everything that goes with it.
Yeah.
And it's there's such a need for more people to have that now than there ever has yeah. been in the past, and we really need to get onto it.
Yeah. Someone's texting asking, are garden or nursery apprenticeships still being offered?
There are apprenticeships. Generally, they're through the TAFE system. Yes. Yep. So they'll do, you know, they'll work with their employer and do a day a week through the TAFE system. Yep. But again, it a lot depends on the quality of the employer and, yep. and how much time they're prepared to spend educating the person in...
Yep. in And I think the interesting thing that I'm reflecting on, the reason for asking the question is, you know, once people get into it, there's a trajectory. But what I'm also quite interested in is what were the initial things? Who were people around, and or what was the environment when someone as a child or as a teenager goes, oh, this is something of interest? You know, often what I'm finding and hearing is that it's a parent. Or it's the home environment that's... So if it's parents or grandparents or people in that kind of village context, you know, who you're around.
Often families
are the influence.
I know in my case, my parents were very interested in plants and things like that, and we'd go out bushwalking, this and that, and they'd tell me what things were. Yep. And I thought that was the case for everyone. And
yes.
I'd get back to school, and then I discovered that actually other people didn't know that was a hakea. And that was, so that all goes on. Yeah, I think the other thing, I mean, for me personally, I remember I went to school in Geelong and at one point I was, for better or worse, I was in a Latin class, and we came up to see some Greek theatre at the University of Melbourne. Yeah. So it was an evening thing. It was, you know, it was an excursion in the minibus and with my other Latin scholars. And while we were there at the university, I was standing looking at a tree, and it turned out it was a ginkgo biloba, and an old professor walked up and started telling me about the ginkgo and why it was different, why it has the primitive venation, how long it's persisted on Earth, and all of that.
Yes.
And, you know, moments like that, little gems like that sort of stick in your mind, and those things can be quite influential, I think, for any impressionable young person. And so I always think, you know, if I'm boring the socks off someone about something or other, I think, well, actually, someone or other might find this interesting, yeah, and it might make a difference.
And I think it's important, because I think that it's the little moments that are the ones that often are the driver that can influence.
Yeah, absolutely.
Greg, what was your original...
All of those things, yeah. The garden I grew up in was planted in the 1870s.
Yes.
The main plant importer for Taylor's and Sangster's Nursery, who probably supplies a lot of the botanic gardens you were talking about earlier, the Victorian ones, especially things like Araucaria.
Yes.
The monkey puzzles all came through Taylor's and Sangster's nursery. I got to work in that old nursery, which hadn't been a nursery for many years, but when I was 16, I used to work in Taylor's and Sangster's nursery in the garden there. It was like somewhere between gardening and archaeology. I think that had a big part to it.
Yep.
And down the end of the road I grew up on was native forest.
Gosh, like what cool a playground. Climate
rainforest.
What and, a playground.
I got to spend a lot of time by myself, which I still do.
Yep.
And, yeah, I just – what's more interesting than – reality.
Yeah.
What about you? Rather than fictional, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And what about you, Jeremy? What was some of the original?
I just fell into influences? It when I was about 22.
Yes.
And it's kind of hard to explain, but I do remember. Well, staying next door to Kew Gardens in 1973, and then the next year I was collecting catalogues, tree catalogues and whatever, and I was thinking, gosh, we're right next to Kew Gardens. I wasn't really paying attention. Very annoying. I mean, it's really quite odd because where we were farming, it's one of the hotspots for floral diversity anywhere. Ran into Kingsley Dixon 2 or 3 months ago. In fact, we were talking about the Drummonds because James Drummond was later put in touch with Charles Darwin. So Drummond and Darwin were corresponding about Leschnaultias.
Yes.
So I was asking Kingsley, what was that about? Because it's mentioned in Rieker's book, but not why. And apparently Charles Darwin was, he went to Western Australia, of course, as he was foraging around the world on the Beagle. And he was as amazed by the floral diversity in Western Australia as he was by the animals of the Galapagos. And he spent the rest of his life tearing his hair out over what was going on. He couldn't figure it out. And so he was looking for information as to the sex life of Leschnaultias. He thought that might help. Didn't. You have to understand continental drift before you can understand Western Australia, and then it starts to fall into place. Yeah. And the first person to talk about continental drift was some years after Darwin died. So unfortunate, but all the same, there was this correspondence going on between these eminent people, despite the fact that the letters were being sent in sailing ships and taking 6 months to arrive. You know, you send off a letter and the reply come back 12 months later, and yet they were writing to each other continuously.
They wrote copious numbers of letters. So Baron von Mueller, I mean, there's been a project running for decades now on documenting his correspondence. I think they've recovered something like, they think about a third of his letters, or no, 10% of his letters, I think it is. And that's about 3,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this is a man who was not sitting there writing letters during the day. So nighttime.
Imagine what how many he'd write now if he had email.
And that's the interesting thing with botanic gardens of the 19th century, is they were all in touch with each other and sending plants backwards and forwards. And, you know, so much of today's horticulture goes back to that cross-fertilisation from the botanic gardens. There's still room for this to happen. In fact, I'm sitting here thinking, what year was it? 3 or 4 years ago, I was sitting here chatting with John Arnott.
Yes.
And halfway through the conversation, John Arnott throws onto the table the fact that they've been collecting these plants from mountaintops in Queensland. Mm. And a lot of them have ended up, has ended up along the road from us in the Olinda Botanic Gardens. So you walk into the Olinda Botanic Gardens now and there's signs to Phil Johnson's Chelsea Garden. Yes. Go along, have a stroll through. Just below Phil Johnson's garden is the Cloud Forest Garden. And their plants rescued from mountaintops in northern Queensland and the Great Divide, ecosystems which are collapsing due to global warming.
Right.
Yeah. So, I was just trying to figure out the Nothofagus a few days ago and suddenly spotted there are 8 species in Papua New Guinea. Mm. So I'm kind of wondering whether now that they've rescued a good number of these plants from these ecosystems in Queensland, whether the team should go their loins and head to Papua New Guinea. But this is, you know, this is vital stuff, and it's all happening awfully quickly.
Yeah. Wow. And there's a lot of global work going on, you know, by Botanica, and particularly the bigger organisations, but also some of the smaller ones. There's a lot of cooperative partnership work going on. I think, you know, for Q, I think there was something around 180 partnerships worldwide with different countries and people working all around the world on a whole range of conservation projects of different sorts. So, and also on, you know, food supply and things like that as well. So I think, you know, once you peel back the sort of the surface of botanic gardens as being nice places to go and wander around in, there's a whole lot of other stuff going on, which is really genuinely valuable.
Yeah, they're not just there for fun. They're really crucial.
Yeah. So when you go and visit them, go and have a chat with the volunteers, go and have a chat with the garden staff. Yeah. If there's anyone that looks like they're working there or has any sort of linkage, meander up to them.
If they've got a nursery, go and buy some plants from the nursery.
Absolutely. Yeah. Go and have a chat, go and talk and go... Now, tell me about the ginkgo.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or whichever plant that it is that's struck an interest to you while you're meandering through the gardens, because generally they'll absolutely love chatting with you.
They will.
And, you know, if you've got your kids with you, if you're taking your kids, let them listen in to the person, because that might just be the conversation that starts to go, wow, that's amazing. This natural world around us is... is delightful, and there's so much to embrace and enjoy with it.
Yep.
Fantastic. It has been wonderful having you all in. I've really enjoyed the conversation and the chats for today. Just want to recap, Richard, we've got Began's
Botanic Gardens
coming
week.
Up this week.
This week,
from the 18th.
Yeah, from... That's Monday, isn't it? Yeah, from Monday, basically for the week. Yeah.
Yep. So for everyone that's listening in, check out the website, bganz.com.
Something. Yeah, com.
Don't know. These days you just need to...
Just Begans.
Begans, yeah. That'd be good. Because as we've been saying, there's so much to see. And book into any of those conversations, any of those workshops or talks that you see. So that's great. Jeremy.
Thank you.
It's been great having you in as well, and to hear you chat and talk about what's happening at Cloud Hill and all the books that you're getting into as well.
I have a huge library.
I can imagine.
The autumn's looking pretty good at the moment, and it should be good for another 3 or 4 weeks or so. And then winter is actually my favourite time.
Right.
If anyone asks, when's the best time to come? Come in June. It's all architecture. Went to a lot of trouble with our architecture, though.
Well, that's a very good point. So, you know, there's a lot. The changing seasons offer many different things
to
enjoy.
And just rug up and come along.
Yeah, excellent.
And as you're walking down into the woods, just take your time. I took a photograph of a lyrebird a couple of days ago from about a metre away.
Oh, gosh.
The thing was just busy. Yeah. So I strolled up to it and then sort of sat down. And for 5-10 minutes, it carried on with its excavation.
Brilliant.
Taking photographs.
That's the season we're in, warring. Lyrebirds are out.
Just take your time. The lyrebirds are very relaxed with people.
Yeah, good, good. And Greg, it's been wonderful to have you in again and
thank you.
Chatting about everything that you've been involved with and enjoying with fungi as well.
Yes.
I always enjoy. I do miss seeing once or twice, once before you brought in some of your whittling, the timber whittling.
Oh, right, yes.
Which was so...
I've been doing plenty of that too.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you to everyone. It's been great having you in. I'd just like to also thank our producers, Di and Susie, that have been helping today and volunteering. And I think Chloe, who has meandered back into this side of the studio. It's great having you here as I continue to learn. Thank you. Also, shout out to our social media team, Liam and Daniel. We wish you all a very happy but wet gardening day today. I know that Richard, you said you've got some plants to plant.
Yep.
So get out into it. I hope you enjoy getting out into that and getting amongst it. I'm Stephen Wells. This is the 3CR Gardening Show. It's been wonderful having you listening in and wish you all very well in your gardening for this coming week. Thanks.
3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.